This is Mark Strassman, reporter with Utopia Media's Book World. We're about to speak to film historian, critic, and an author, David Thompson. Welcome to Utopia Media's Book World.
Thank you very much.
We're talking about Fantan. Why don't you tell us how you got involved in the project?
Well, I was called up one day by Sonny Mater, who is the publisher and chief editor at Alfred Knopf, and has therefore been my publisher for most of, I suppose, the last 20 years. Most of the books I've done with them. And you know, he's a personal friend. And he said, look, something very strange has happened. About 20-plus years ago, when he was in England, he had commissioned this novel by Marlon Brando and Donald Cammell. It had died away, but with the death of Brando, a manuscript had been found, not quite complete, and it was being re-presented. And clearly, it was a novel that needed finishing up and tidying up. And because it had all happened some time ago, and I think because people probably didn't know who Donald Cammell was, it needed some kind of introduction or afterword that would explain what had happened and give the reader a better sense of judging the book. And he wondered whether I'd be interested in doing those two things. So that's how it came about.
How long did it take you to decide that you wanted to?
Well, he said, take a look at the book. You know, that's the key.
Right.
Because I don't think it's worth doing if we don't think the novel's worth doing.
Right.
And he sent it to me, and my impression was really this, that it's not a great book, it's not a great work of fiction, but it's a fun adventure story, a lot of action, good characters, and beyond that, it was a tremendous insight into Brando, and I thought on those two accounts, it would be well worth doing. And I think once I'd read the book, you know, I didn't have any doubt at all about it, and I was excited to be involved, and I was flattered.
As you recounted in the afterword, and
yeah.
As you did the research, share with us a little bit about its provenance and how it actually came into existence.
Well, Donald Cammell was a Scot, and he was a man of many skills and talents who probably never really fulfilled any of them. In Britain in the late 60s, he was the driving force on a famous cult film called Performance. And he had met Brando as early as the late 1950s. And they had become friends. And they had an up-and-down friendship, but it sustained over the years. And in the late 1970s, by which time Cammell was living in Los Angeles, Brando approached him and said, look, I've got this idea for a pirate story movie, and I want to do it in a way that we don't do it inside the Hollywood system. And I know you're someone who likes to work outside the system. Would you be my collaborator on the story? And what that meant in the first instance was that they got together, they schemed out the story and the characters, and they wrote a treatment of about 160 pages.
A treatment for a film?
For a film. There's no question that in the first instance, the idea was that it would be a movie and that Brando would play the leading part. Now, something happened. Brando lost interest. And rather than try to raise the money for the film, as Cammell had thought he would, he really just let it lie fallow. So Cammell at that point said, well, suppose we did it as a novel first, and if the novel drew some attention, that would probably help get the film made. And Brando said, sure, okay. And so Cammell made the publishing deal, and Camel turned it into a novel, or at least he turned part of the treatment into a novel. Not the whole treatment. I think he saw that the opening part of the treatment, the first third approximately, would work better as a novel. And he did the draft of the novel, submitted it to Brando. Brando made some changes and some suggestions, but essentially Camel wrote the novel from the treatment they had both done.
And then why wasn't it published immediately
because
after that?
Yet again, Brando lost interest at the end. This is a terrible, tragic pattern in his life of launching projects and then running out of interest in them. And that's why the novel was left unfinished.
So in other words, it was going to be a movie, but he lost interest in that, and Camel turned it into a book.
And he lost interest in that.
And then he lost interest in that,
right.
And then the book lay fallow until both of them had died. And
Brando owned the rights to it all, you see.
Right.
And so that if he didn't want to proceed, there was nothing Camel could do about it.
Right.
And it was only after Brando died, just over a year ago,
right,
that Camel's widow brought the project back to life. Camel had died about 8 years before Brando died.
Now, Camel's widow may have played some role in this whole dynamic herself.
Well, she's a remarkable woman. And,
tell us about her, and you can give her a name and so on, and how does she fit into all this?
Her name is Gina Kong.
Right.
She certainly got a great deal of Chinese blood. How much, I'm not quite sure.
Right.
But here is the really interesting thing. She had been a family friend to Brando in that her mother had been one of Brando's mistresses.
That would be Anita Loos.
Anita, yes. And you know, there was no doubt about that, and it was quite well known.
He wasn't, to make it even too more exciting, her father, was he?
I don't think there's the least possibility
of
that.
Okay, all right.
But Brando had been in the house, and he'd known the child, he'd played with her, he'd taken her to the zoo and things like that, you know. And he was fond of her and protective of her. Now, Camel comes along.
Say just a little bit more. He essentially grew up at the knee of Aleister Crowley, didn't he?
He is a pretty wild man himself.
Right.
Yeah, and he'd had an upbringing. His father was a writer and a painter, and Donald was at first a painter. And Crowley had been his godfather.
Right.
And he was very much a key figure in London in the swinging 60s.
Right.
And anyone who knows performance knows it's about sex and drug-taking and violence. And, you know, he was certainly very familiar with those worlds. He comes to Los Angeles. He meets Gina Kong when she is of an uncertain age, but underage.
Right.
And he starts a romance with her. And Brando is furious because he feels a kind of, not paternal role, but he feels protective. And it spoils his friendship with Camel for a while. But the romance, which seems like that of a teenager and a much older man, turns into marriage. And when they get married, Brando says, well, you know, marriage is a big step, and if you're going to get married, then I give you my blessing and I congratulate you. And the friendship resumed. And it was really just after the friendship resumed that Brando made Camel the offer of being collaborator on Phantom.
Is it your view that there might have been some residual resentment
yes.
On the part of Brando that
yes.
against Camel that exacerbated his Brando's tendency to pick up projects and drop them led
yeah.
to some of the complexities here?
I spell this out in the afterword, and it's a complicated story,
right.
but I think that there was always a quality of sexual rivalry between the two men.
Right.
And Brando was very attracted to Asian women, very interested in the way their minds worked, very attracted to them physically. Camel obviously was too. One of the two leading characters in the book is a Chinese woman who's the leader of a band of pirates. And I don't say that that character is based on China Kong in detail, but I think it's a character certainly that benefits from both men's understanding of how Asian women thought and felt.
Now, right after I finished reading Fantan, I was able to see Mutiny on the Bounty with Brando.
Yes.
On television, and I could see the really close connection between the themes and so on in the two books. Could you comment on that a little bit?
Well, Mutiny on the Bounty is a sort of turning point in Brando's life, in that although the film was a really rather famous disaster, lost a lot of money, and it was a very problematic film being made, it was the film, above all, that introduced Brando to the South Seas.
Right.
And it's clear he fell in love with the area, fell in love with several women from the area, and it's soon after that that he begins to buy his own property, Tetiaroa, the island in Tahiti, and, you know, takes up this life of a kind of beachcomber sailor, all at a very expensive level, you understand.
Right.
But loved the area, loved its history, and I think this is where the genesis of his idea for a pirate story. He began to read books about the South Seas and thought, well, a pirate story would be a lot of fun, and had a real feeling both for ships and the sea and that kind of thing. He was quite a fond sailor, and Hamill was not a sailor at all.
Right.
But Brando, I think, did love the sea.
Now, there's quite a storm, and it takes up a whole chapter in the book. And,
yeah,
and I was watching the storms as the sailors on the Bounty tried to go around the cape there and
yeah.
have the storm. They seemed
there's a resemblance.
There's a strong resemblance there.
Yeah, no, I think there is, and I mean, I think that, you know, I think Brando knew that if you were going to do a sea story, you had to have a storm in there at some point, and he'd read about storms. I think he'd probably been in some fairly serious storms, but there is that storm in Mutiny on the Bounty. Yeah.
Okay, now, but before, we don't want to shortchange the book itself. We've been talking about the story about it. It seems to me, if this, it's sort of getting ahead of ourselves, that if this is made into a film, it seems from the relative excitement about the story about the making of the book versus what's in the book, that it might make sense to do the film the same way, in which the story of the relationship of Camel and Brando and
Gina
is kind of the frame, and the making of this becomes kind of not as much as the Terry Gilliam's Man of La Mancha.
No, I know what you mean.
But something along the lines that would frame it within that context.
I think that would be very interesting. Yeah.
Okay. Well, as a preparation for that, tell us now a little bit about Fantan and the story and Fantan and the characters. And
it is set in 1927, and we begin in the jail in Hong Kong prison, and in the jail is this character, Anatole Daltrey, known as Annie Daltrey. He's a man. He's Scots-American. He's in his early 50s. He's an adventurer. He's a sailor. He has his own ship. He's knocked around the world, knocked around the seven seas, never made his fortune, had a lot of adventures, and he's had a mishap because he was caught running some guns, and he ends up in jail. And he manages in jail, but he decides that by the time you're in your early 50s, jail is really too much. And he can't do that again. And he decides that he's got to really make a killing, put something aside for his old age. And he realizes that inside the jail, there are people who are members of this famous Chinese pirate gang, and he insinuates himself with them. He tries to get on their good side, so that when he's released from jail, he might get an offer from the gang. And so it turns out. And the woman who leads that gang, makes an approach to him, and enlists him finally.
Makes him an offer he can't refuse.
Well, certainly an offer he's not going to refuse.
Right.
Makes him an offer to be part of a plan to rob a ship that is going to set sail, they know when, which they think has got a cargo of silver.
Now, as I got into the book, it sounded to me like a Western set in the ocean, where the gang gets together, they're going to make the one last score, they're going to rob the big bank in town,
that's right.
So on, and it really...
Well, I think you've made a very shrewd observation about pirate stories, in a way.
Right.
They are Westerns under sail,
in
some sense.
Okay, well, tell us a little bit more about this...
Annie Daltrey... goes on board. He takes the place of a man who has conveniently fallen sick. Of course, he's only fallen sick because the pirate band has bribed him.
Right.
He's the radio operator, and another one of Annie's great talents is that he loves amateur radio, just as Marlon Brando did.
Right.
And he takes the job of radio operator on the ship, and I don't want to spell out every detail, but the radio operator is in a very important position, and he is able to allow the pirates to make their first attack on the ship, and you've got to read the rest.
You
of the
do
rest.
Have to do it.
But there you are.
Now, have you been able to pull out the threads about what Camel and what Brando contributed to the plotting?
It's very, very difficult, because they basically sat down and talked it out. And we know that Camel ended up doing the writing, but of course very often in partnerships one person talks and the other one writes.
Right.
But what it turned out was that in the Brando estate there were transcripts of a number of recordings of their conversations. Brando, as I just said, was a man who loved radio. He loved tape recorders, too.
Right.
And he recorded a great deal of what he was involved in. And I had access to some of these transcripts. And
did you have access to the tapes? Or just the transcripts?
Not the tapes.
Do they still exist? Is there going to be a CD of those?
I believe they still exist. What the estate's plans are, I don't know.
Right.
Are there, in fact, more
recordings of Brando on subjects other than the writing of his book that might make a huge cache?
I'm led to believe that there is a mass of recordings.
You edit those or something?
I've not been asked yet, but I think that when a biographer comes along, they're going to be gold.
Right.
What emerges from these transcripts is that Brando really saw himself as Annie Daltrey,
right,
and acted out the character,
right,
and invented his dialogue and perfected it and reworked it.
This is the opposite of what he did in Apocalypse Now, where they had to read him his lines. Here he's making up the dialogue.
Well, you know, there were different times in his life,
right.
Say.
Right.
But I think what he did here was say, now I think Annie would do so and so, and he'd move over and he'd say something like, what would I say? And he gets into character,
right,
and he comes up with the lines, and Camel's taking it all down.
Right.
So that everything in the book that is to do with Annie Daltrey, I think, has got Brando's imprint on it. Now,
right.
there's a whole lot that isn't Annie Daltrey.
Well, I wanted to ask about that. There's a whole lot of politics and history there.
Yes.
And some observations about the political situation in China.
Yeah.
That, to my knowledge, seem pretty accurate.
Well, and I think that comes from Camel's research.
Okay.
I mean, Camel had been raised as a man who had a house with a big library in it. His father was a book collector. And Sheena Kong told me that, because she was there at the time, that when he was doing the novel, Donald went down to the UCLA library, spent a lot of time there, and found a number of books that were about China in this period. And I agree with you. I think that the factual background and Annie's relationship with the warlords, including Chiang Kai-shek at that time, is based on good research.
Okay. How fully realized are the characters in Fantan, and how much does that matter to this whole experience?
Well, I would say that they are well realized. I mean, I think that Daltrey is a very strange guy, and I think that you do feel and hear Brando in him quite a lot. I think that Madame, the leader of the gang, is a more conventional gang. She's a sort of, she's a young Chinese femme fatale,
right.
Wily, cunning, seductive,
intelligent.
But very intelligent, yeah. Yes. I think she's a more conventional character, but I think at the level of a pirate story, she stands up very well. And, what is so tempting, I think, is to imagine the Brando of previous age acting with, say, one of these great young Chinese actresses like Gong Li,
right.
of today's era,
right.
You can really see the chemistry that could have been between them.
So he was pretty much ahead of his, or they were pretty much ahead of their time in creating this character. That now there are actresses who could play it.
Chinese film has come to life, and,
right.
and so we've discovered a whole lot of actors and actresses who are very good. And at the time they did this book, we didn't really know about those people, but if you put the two periods together, you can see how it could work. And I think that even if you were to do it today, I think that Annie could be someone like Russell Crowe, and it would not be difficult to find a beautiful young Chinese actress who could play the part.
All right. What do you know about any concrete efforts to actually turn this into a film at the moment?
Well, I know that the Brando estate and the Camel estate are very interested in doing it, and I think that whether the novel does well may be a key part of it. The other thing is that these days, that kind of film, big seascapes and action, is pretty expensive, so it would be a big picture, and it would be a big investment, and that's going to be difficult to put together.
Well, the solution may be the one we came up with a few minutes ago.
I like that idea very much.
To make it around the relationship
with right.
those people, and then just shoot a few scenes.
I think that's a great idea.
You might even be able to recut some of the footage from Mutiny on the Bounty if you get
the
storm, and
that
who knows.
And
there's computer graphics, of course.
It would certainly involve that.
Why don't we focus a little bit on your contribution here? We talked about how the project came to you. How much editing did you have to do?
Well, the book...
And how much creation of stuff from outline did you have to do?
What I had was a typescript that was not really very thoroughly arranged. So what I did was break it into chapters.
Right.
There was a little bit of repetition. There were two or three places where they said, scene to come, that we'll deal with so-and-so.
Right.
So those little scenes I had to do.
Right.
There were just two or three places where I thought the writing was a bit obscure, and I simplified it. But basically, that's what I did, plus what really amounts to the final chapter. Now, there was a synopsis for that. There was an outline.
Right.
And the outline of events, I thought, in the synopsis, was excellent. I thought the ending they had to the book was just exactly the ending there should be.
Right.
So I followed the outline, and really all I did was read the book several times to try and get its atmosphere and its voice in my head, and then wrote the last chapter,
Did you try to apply what you know as a film historian and critic to creating the kind of story you'd like to see?
I was trying to make it as exciting and interesting as I could.
Right.
I was trying to be faithful to what they were doing. I was trying to keep everything I knew about Brando in mind, too. There's a sort of wonderful, sad fatalism about Brando, I think, in a lot of his films. And I tried to use that and develop that. But really, I felt equal interest in Brando and Camel, and I felt sad for them that this thing had never come to fruition, and I wanted to do something that they might have been pleased with.
It's kind of a happier book than either of their lives, isn't it?
Well, it is, really. And I mean, neither one of them ended well. And I think they had a great deal of fun during their lives, but there is a real sadness to both those stories. Camel killed himself, and you can argue in a funny way, I suppose, that Brando let himself get to such a stage that death was certain.
Right.
Yeah.
Why don't you wrap up by telling us what your hopes for the book are, and why you think people ought to take a look at it, to buy it, read it, and encourage their local film studios to turn it into a movie.
Well, if someone says to me, why should I buy and read the book? I would say, well, I think it's an adventurous, page-turning pirate story, and I think it's good fun. I don't think it's Joseph Conrad, but I think you'll enjoy it. I think if you read the whole thing with the afterword, you'll get an interesting insight into a strange collaboration between Brando and Camel. And I think that in the days when Hollywood doesn't seem to know too well what to make films about, I think this could make a pretty good adventure story.
After all, Pirates of the Caribbean turned out pretty well.
That did.
The studios.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I want to thank you very much.
My pleasure.
For talking to us about Fantan. And, before we go, tell us just what Fantan is and how it's a leitmotif throughout the book and how they're gambling, et cetera, and how the big project is really a role of the Fantan here.
Well, Fantan is a Chinese game of chance. It's a sort of card game played with counters. And there's a key point where Madame and Annie are haggling over whether they're going to make a deal. And they determine their doubts in a game of Fantan, where pretty clearly the result has been fixed.
We won't say in which direction.
Let the reader find out.
Yeah. But in fact, I saw the whole gamble on this score.
The whole
was in fact a Fantan type of thing, right?
No question. I think it's a book about gambling altogether.
Okay, good. All right. Thanks again for talking to
my
us
on
Utopia's Book World. Bye.
Okay.
Bye.
Goodbye.